Well, good evening, everybody. My name is John Yoder. I teach in the Political Science Department. I would like to welcome you here this evening. This is part of Whitworth's Speakers and Artists series. There are a number of programs that we hold over the course of the year, programs about current events, programs involving artists, various kinds of things. And if you check the Whitworth website, you can find out what those are. Lindy Scott, who's here someplace, is the coordinator of that program. And so welcome to everybody who's here tonight, to the Whitworth community, and also there are a lot of visitors, some students from Gonzaga Prep and other people here, and we're delighted to have you. This is a very, very, as I was saying to Ambassador Crocker, a very interesting time, and obviously your presence indicates the level of interest you have in what's going on in the world, what's going on in the Middle East. And we're very fortunate this evening that Ambassador Ryan Crocker is here to talk to us about his experiences and talk to us about what is happening in the Middle East and what may happen. The title of his talk is Iraq, A New American Foreign Policy? Ryan, as you know, is a Spokane native. He graduated from Whitman College with a BA in English, so good for the liberal arts. And he joined the State Department immediately after college and spent most of his career in the Middle East. He's been posted to Qatar. He was in Beirut as the chief political officer at the time the embassy was bombed in Beirut, Lebanon. He's been in Cairo, Afghanistan, ambassador to Pakistan, ambassador to Syria, and as everybody here knows, ambassador to Iraq, his last post. He's studied Arabic, is fluent in Arabic, studied Persian, has spent a year at Princeton studying Near Eastern, taking courses in Near Eastern studies. He's been awarded many honors by the United States State Department, and I won't mention them, all of them, but he received the rank of career ambassador, which is the highest rank that you can achieve in the State Department. And in 2009, he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. As I said, these are very interesting times. We have a new administration, a new foreign policy. Right now, people are trying to decide what to do about Afghanistan. Are there lessons from Iraq? And I'm sure we're all eager to hear what Ambassador Crocker has to say. So let's welcome Ambassador Ryan Crocker.
Thank you, Don. No. Thank you, John, and good evening to all of you. I can tell from the turnout that it is a wet, boring night on the Whitworth campus. Just good to be indoors out of the rain, and the library is the only other choice. I do appreciate that at least some of you have given up the fifth and I hope final game of the National League Championship Series to attend this lecture. That's where my heart is tonight, I have to tell you. This is the first baseball season I have had a chance to experience from end to end in about three decades, so it's been important to me. Let me start out with a pitch to all of you who are college students here or elsewhere. Your presence here tonight tells me you're interested in international affairs, in the Middle East in particular, and I really would encourage all of you to sign up for the Foreign Service exam. You may not have a thought in the world of ever joining the Foreign Service, but you know what? It's one Saturday out of your lives. It's free, and who knows what doors it may open up to you. At a minimum, it will tell you what the Foreign Service thinks about your level of knowledge, not only in international affairs, but in everything else that the examination covers, which include but are not limited to art, literature, economics, mathematics, and architecture. So think about it. After more than a decade and a half of drought, the Foreign Service is hiring again, making up for lost time, and that's both the traditional Foreign Service and also for those developmentally inclined USAID. So that would be my my commercial intervention here at the outset of the lecture. The title that John proposed and in which I acquiesced, Toward a New Foreign Policy, Lessons from Iraq. It's worth thinking just a bit about the challenges of foreign policy formulation in America, besides the ones that we focus on day to day, that whatever a president decides he wants to do, he then has to get resourced by Congress, which may have very different views, even if it's the same party. But to a more deeper challenge, I'd suggest to you, America is a unique country in so many ways, one of them being, of course, that we are a nation that is founded on a set of principles. Most countries, the overwhelming majority of countries in the world, are not. They have existed for, in many cases, very long times. The Western Hemisphere, broadly speaking, is an exception, and America is certainly an exception. But this presents interesting philosophical challenges when you consider how you're going to interact with the rest of the world. Is it going to be on the basis of coldly calculated, sometimes ruthless national interests? Well, that's kind of hard for us because our national interests, as defined in our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution, are based on principles. So if you're talking about principles, you're talking universals. If they're going to be good for us, they really have to be good for everybody. I mean, that's the point of a principle. It's not limited in geography or in time. So that leads you to some interesting questions. When the instruments of statecraft available to you, the various elements of national power, begin to dramatically exceed those of your adversaries, individually or in combination, one can almost argue, and of course, indeed, some have argued, that we then have not only the opportunity, but indeed the obligation to see that other countries and other peoples suffering from despotic regimes have the same right, opportunity, and chance at the principles that have made this country great. I just lay all this out because in foreign policy, if you're a superpower, nothing is particularly easy. And you see this, I think, highlighted in the case of Iraq. Iraq in 2002-2003 was a dilemma for almost everyone in this country who thought deeply about it. And you almost saw a reversal of traditional roles where the right wing, if you will, in politics, those known for their realism and their cynicism in foreign affairs were advocating regime change and a new democratic era in the Middle East, consistent with America's principles. And the left, the liberal element of society, was in the uncomfortable position of saying, we really don't want to do this. It's okay to let this ruthless tyranny continue that has done so much damage in the region and inflicted such horrors on its own people. So that that would be my first lesson personally from Iraq. There are no easy choices. There are no simple or simple choices. Those that are pretty well guaranteed to be simplistic. These are hard issues. They present hard challenges. They did in 2002. and they certainly do so today, as we look at the array of issues in the Middle East. Now, that would take me to another lesson on Iraq, which simply put is, be careful what you get into. And that, again, I think is not as simplistic as it might sound. I have this map up here because, again, we Americans are a great people. You represent the best of our future hope. Nonetheless, we have our limitations, and you may have as well. One of them is we are geographically challenged, so that's up there just so you kind of know what's connected to what. You know, that Turkey does not, in fact, share a border with Belgium, as I have actually heard asserted. Be careful what you get into, because major actions, particularly in this part of the world, can be the gift that keeps on giving for a very long period of time. So it's not just second and third order consequences that you have to foresee and attempt to plan for. It's 20th and 30th and 40th order consequences that at an outset of an action you cannot begin to even conceive of, let alone coherently plan for. So if it comes to regime change in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Lebanon in the early 1980s, where I was also a witness, think long and hard, because the consequences of policy choices made at the beginning of the 1980s in Lebanon still inform developments and outlooks in that country and indeed in the broader Middle East. You have to understand the histories. If we are geographically challenged, I would suggest to you we are often also historically challenged. Americans, by and large, don't want to spend a lot of time on yesterday. Yesterday's over. It's today, it's tomorrow, and it's the day after. Forward-looking. It's what built this country. But other countries and other cultures are perhaps more focused on their historical narratives. They know what happened where they are, or they know their narrative of what happened where they are. It influences how they look at us and how they view developments, and we are all too often generally unaware of what that history and what those narratives may be. Certainly important in the case of Iraq, equally important, I would suggest to you, in the case of Afghanistan or Pakistan. In my line of work, you don't normally suffer from sleepless nights given the opportunity to sleep like soldiers, you sleep. Otherwise, you drop from exhaustion. My only string of sleepless nights of any length was in that late 2002, early 2003 period, not because I could foresee disaster, pain, and loss, but because of the totality of what I could not foresee. Once we crossed the line of departure, then what? There is no person alive who could have come anywhere close to predicting in March 2003 where we are today in Iraq. So, again, that's that second lesson. First lesson is no easy choices. The second one is be careful what you get into. And that takes me to a third interrelated lesson. It's the need for strategic patience. And patience, like geography and history, is something also that Americans don't do brilliantly well. again, give it to me today, and if I can't get it by tomorrow, I'm moving on to something else. This in a region of the world in which all too often our enemies are not really organized to be in the fight against us until quite a bit after we think we've already won a total victory. So be careful getting in. Perhaps be even more careful about getting out. Abandonment of objectives, radical change of courses also have dramatic consequences. I would cite you one again in Lebanon. When the United States military withdrew from Lebanon in early 1984, a number of countries in the region drew their own conclusions from that. Two of them, of course, Lebanon's near and far neighbors, Syria and Iran, which had formed a strategic axis in the wake of the 1982 Israeli invasion, and worked together to create Hezbollah, with which we continue to deal today, drew the conclusion, and this is consistent with Middle Eastern political culture, that, well, couldn't keep the Americans out, or the Israelis for that matter, so you have to let them come in, just as the region had to let the British, the French, the Russians, the Italians, as well as the Americans come in for, pick your date, at least the last two plus centuries. You work on them once they are in. They always tell you in public speaking, do not, repeat not, use sports metaphors. So in this case, it would be the metaphor of boxing. They know they haven't got a left cross that's going to stop us before we get to them. They go for the clinch and see how much damage they can do to the ribs of the big Western interloper and how long that interloper can take it. That informed, I would suggest to you, the Syrian and Iranian approach to the U.S. presence in Iraq. And by late 2006, again, working much as they did in Lebanon more than 20 years before, they thought that they had another example of the winning combination. Syria would back Ba'athi party remnants, facilitate al-Qaeda's access to Iraq through the West. The Iranians would back Shia extremist militias that looked and acted an awful lot like Hezbollah two decades previously, and they would see how we liked it. And again, it's a little, I think, understood element of the surge, what is known as the surge, the new way forward that President Bush ordered at the end of 2006, that ran against type for several of our adversaries in the region, that instead of stepping back when the pain commenced to escalate, we actually stepped forward. The last couple of years in Iraq have not been particularly good ones for the Iranians, and I think they're still trying to figure out what they're dealing with and how to position themselves vis-a-vis both the United States and an Iraqi government that is actually starting to act like an Iraqi government. I won't take you through the kind of the chronology of events over the last couple of years in Iraq. I'm happy to get into that in questions if that's where your interests take you. Suffice it to say, though, and again, that's why all of my lessons link up, as much as we have seen in 6.5 years, this is still just the beginning of the story of the new Iraq. I mean, we're still in chapter one. We may think this baby's over. We're on our way home. Definitely time to switch the channels. that's not the way this region works. So we have seen the Iraqis, with our assistance, face and overcome incredible challenges, yet incredible challenges remain. Sectarian violence, the vicious fighting between Sunni and Shia Arabs that characterized so much of 2006 and early 2007 has subsided. But now we're seeing, in place of sectarian violence, we're seeing ethnic tension between Kurds and Arabs. Not to the point of any significant violence, and I think prudent leadership and action can avoid it, but it is a huge challenge. And overlaid with that ethnic challenge is an institutional and constitutional challenge. What are the appropriate relationships between the federal government in Baghdad, the regional government in Kurdistan, and the different provincial governments around the country? Very much an element of debate, as is the question of the authorities of the legislative branch versus the executive, the prime minister. This should all sound a little familiar, because the Iraqis are having their own states' rights argument. And when we ask ourselves, well, you know, why don't they just get on with it, sort these things out, and quit whining and complaining, it's worth bearing in mind in our own history that if you date our creation, aspirational, not actual, July 4, 1776, 87 years later, it was the day after the Battle of Gettysburg. So it took us almost 9 decades and the bloodiest conflict in our own history to sort out what kind of state, what kind of society we were going to be. And of course, we are still very much a work in progress. So the issues Iraq is dealing with, again, are existential. And what I would say there is, I hope America is not too quick to decide this program is over. During my final months in Iraq, we negotiated 2 very important agreements. One, the security agreement that provides for the phased redeployment and eventual withdrawal of all U.S. forces by the end of 2011. That's the one that got the headlines. There was a second agreement, the strategic framework agreement, that lays out the structure for the U.S.-Iraqi relationship in a variety of areas that I think may have far more of a lasting impact. Because there, what we tried to do with not only full cooperation from, but with the strong urging of Iraqis, was create a dynamic that could fundamentally reshape how Iraq looks at the U.S., the international community, and its own region. For the last half a century, since the 1958 revolution, Iraq has defined itself in an adversarial relationship with or outright hostility to most of its neighbors, most of the international community, certainly us. There is now a chance for a fundamental reorientation. And that is exemplified by the presence of Prime Minister al-Maliki in Washington today. He met yesterday with President Obama, and he is here for a conference on trade and investment opportunities in Iraq. It's Maliki's second visit in 3 months, incidentally. And the fact that he is doing it in election season, national elections are scheduled for January, suggests pretty clearly that he also finds it good politics at home to emphasize the U.S. relationship. That is an enormous opportunity, I think, for them, for us, and for the international community in general when you look at the past of a set of Iraqi regimes that invaded two of its neighbors, attempted to subvert most of the rest, threatened to burn half of Israel, and presented probably the biggest single challenge to the post-World War II international order that we have yet seen. So, again, slow to get in, even slower to get out, take a long view, display some strategic patience. That would take me to a third lesson, or fourth, which is new foreign policies. You know, we like new. New's fun, new's good, let's get on with it. New this, new that. You know, when I came back, the first thing I did was buy two 2009 brand new cars, and that was a lot of fun. But new is not necessarily good at all in foreign policy. Administrations may change, but the complex regions of the world may not, and probably do not. So again, continuity, and that takes you back again to strategic patience, care in changing course. And I'm pleased to say that that is pretty much the way I see us working right now in this complex part of the world. The Obama administration got a good handoff on Iraq, and the president made that clear in his March speech at Camp Lejeune, that he was embracing the agreements that the Bush administration had negotiated and signed, and particularly emphasizing the importance of the strategic framework agreement. So here we see continuity on a key foreign policy challenge, which is Iraq. You don't find many significant points of departure between what the Bush administration was doing in its final months, the run-up to the immediate aftermath of the two agreements, and what the Obama administration is doing. Thank goodness we don't have a brand new Iraq policy. It took us long enough to get this one reasonably right. So again, you dress it up, you change some of the clothes, but you basically carry on with a consistent policy. And I think that is key to remember. Freshness and newness, again, part of a theme that's made this country great. Be very careful with it when you're dealing with complex contingencies overseas. Now, having enumerated some of those lessons and harking back to my initial comments on American exceptionalism and the universality of American principles, I will now take those few lessons and then apply them to the entire region here. And I'll do that very briefly because I'd like this to be more of a dialogue than a monologue. If we look at the challenge of Iran, and I don't know how things are going to develop in this region over the coming months and years, but Iran and its quest for a nuclear weapon may emerge as the largest single challenge for the Obama administration, larger than Iraq, Pakistan, or Afghanistan. And here, I think you can kind of, you'll see all of these principles or these lessons that I've mentioned come into play. First is consistency. Looking at the country, the region, and the world as that country looks at it. In the case of Iran, I think this is particularly important. Iran has always seen itself as a regional superpower. And you can take that back as far in history as you want to go. Certainly to the time of the Safavids in Iran facing the Ottomans with Iraq, more often than not, the front line of that particular clash of cultures. Certainly through the time of the Shah. No one in America remembers it anymore, but the Shah did something fairly unique in the early 70s, which was to deploy a significant element of his ground forces into the Arabian Peninsula, down on the Yemeni-Omani border at the request of the Sultan of Oman, to help the Omanis repulse a South Yemeni-backed insurgency. But the Shah's real message to the region was, I'm the big guy here. I have an army that I can deploy and sustain and that can fight and that can triumph well beyond my borders. The Shah's navy seized three small islands up in the Persian Gulf that had belonged to the United Arab Emirates. Again, same message. So then you have 1979 and the Iranian Revolution. A total regime change, but Iran's sense of itself did not change. So that, in my view, is why you saw, just a few years later, the emergence of Hezbollah in Lebanon, because the Iranians were changing the instruments. It was going to be unconventional forces, not conventional forces, but power projection beyond its borders was going to be the same consistent theme it always had been. In more recent times, we have seen Iranian support for Hamas, the Palestine Islamic Jihad, in the Palestinian territories. Again, the same mechanism at work here. In my view, this has far less to do with the Islamic ideology of the regime, because after all, in the case of Hamas and the PIJ, they're supporting an existential and ideological enemy, because between Shia Islam and Sunni Islam, there can be only one single truth, yet they're doing it anyway, again, power projection beyond their borders, because that's who they are. Now, you get that little mini history lesson because it's very relevant to what I think we're looking at right now. My own view is that whoever rules in Tehran, that government will seek a nuclear weapons capability, consistent with who they see themselves as being, certainly consistent in a region where they know their direct neighbor to the east, Pakistan, has nuclear weapons, and in which they are absolutely convinced their slightly farther neighbor to the west, Israel, also has them. So had the Shah never fallen, I think we would be seeing something of the same dynamic underway. What to do about it? And here again, I think you see one of my other lessons coming into play. Consistency. I think the Obama administration has done exactly what I would hope to see them do, and that is engage the Security Council, the European Union, the rest of the region to demonstrate that Iranian nuclear capability isn't a problem just for the U.S. or just for Israel. It's an international problem. That is a continuation of the policy that the Bush administration had set with the P5 plus one. And again, when you look at the choices, I think this is the one that makes sense. I mean, you've got the two A's, acquiescence and attack. Neither of those, to me, look very good at all. That leaves you, and it comes back to my first lesson, a very hard third choice, because multilateral diplomacy is always hard. Again, trying to fashion an international consensus saying we can't go there, we're not going to let you get there, and making it as difficult as and as long and as hard as you conceivably can for the Iranians. And that's what you see going on right now with the IAEA brokered talks. You may have seen the head of the IAEA come forward with a proposal for the transfer of low-enriched uranium from Iran to third countries. We have embraced it, all part of a painstaking process in which we're doing everything we can to see that we're part shaping and leading, but part of a broad international consensus. And again, that's continuity. A word on Afghanistan and Pakistan that is very much the flavor of the month, the shape of the debate. Iraq is back there with the want ads. And incidentally, that's where Dave Petraeus and I, back in 07, had the goal of putting it. We knew there would never be a day when the media was full of good news about Iraq. So we figured if we could just stop the bad news and move from there to no news, we would have succeeded, and that's about where we are. I just hope no news does not then translate into not-so-benign neglect, again, of a country that is always going to be at the center of this volatile region. And again, all of these lessons, I think, crank into play one more time. We're there. We've been there since 2001. We have been there in differing numbers with differing objectives, but again, we're there. And as we debate now whether we should be there or not, or how many of us should be there doing what, again, it's instructive to look at the history. This is a film we have seen before. We were there in a very big way, of course, in the 1980s when the Soviets invaded the country. Not that we sent our conventional forces, we did not, but we organized and equipped a powerful insurgency in Afghanistan that eventually caused the Soviets to pull out in 1989. When they did that, of course, we said, we win. That's great. Afghanistan is over. We can now collapse the tents and head out the door. And in the process of heading out the door, our relationship with Pakistan went from one of the most allied of allies through the 1980s, because most of that jihad was staged out of Pakistan's northwest frontier, to making Pakistan the most sanctioned of adversaries. The Presser Amendment in 1990 put a total end to all economic and military assistance to Pakistan. But we were done. The 1990s unfolded with a pretty horrific civil war in Afghanistan, in which the Taliban, by the middle of the decade, finally gained ascendancy. The Pakistanis, and again, it may not be accurate history, but it is their narrative, left to its own devices in a horrifically dangerous part of the world for them, did what it had to do. And yes, it cut deals with the Taliban. There are more Pashtuns in Pakistan than there are in Afghanistan. You do not want to be at daggers drawn with a regime that could do so much damage to you, particularly when you don't have any reliable external allies. So that process, of course, culminated in 9/11, where al-Qaeda, given strategic depth by the Taliban, room to plan, did just that. So here we are today. We're back. We're back in Afghanistan, obviously. And here again, having had a front row seat for more than 2.5 years, first in Afghanistan and then in Pakistan, I see continuity. A 17,000 troop plus up in 2006, 2007 would have made no sense whatsoever. Could actually have precipitated more resistance from the Taliban faster than we actually got. Again, you need to understand countries and regions in their own terms and always understand the enemy has a vote. And this particular enemy spent a lot of time and a lot of effort pulling itself back up from the weeds and reconstituting itself as a very potent force. I don't think that the answer to this challenge is to say, we're done here, it's costing too much, it's taken too long, too much in blood and treasure. Again, we have seen that movie. I can tell you the Taliban and Al-Qaeda linkages are tighter now because of what they've been through together in that border area than they were even back in the 1990s. So we're in the middle of a policy review. It is the president who has to set or reset the policy, has to lay out the goals, talk clearly about the difficulty of achieving them, the resources that will be required, the time it may take, the consequences of different course of actions. Again, that's something that General Petraeus and I tried to communicate in 07 to the American people and to Congress. You're tired of this? We got it. We understand. Okay, then let's talk seriously about what the consequences of going in a different direction are, because at that time in Iraq, those consequences, I would suggest to you, would have been pretty alarming over the longer term. So, again, through all of this, I think you see, you know, my hard lessons learned over time all coming into play, whether it's Iraq, whether it's Afghanistan and Pakistan, and indeed the next contingency down the line, who knows what it will be, but there will be one. Post-Cold War history has shown us that. So, again, no easy choices. Be careful what you get into. Be even more careful what you try to get out of. Ask the hard questions. And above all, draw on strategic patience, because it is a very long war. Our adversaries know it. And we need to understand that as well. I'm reminded of that standing here before you today, because the day after tomorrow will be the 26th anniversary of the bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut, something I will never forget. I was there for that, as I was the embassy bombing 6 months earlier. But again, actions have consequences. The importance of strategic patience is paramount, because we are certainly engaged in a region where our adversaries do have that patience in spades. So that's a little longer than I wanted to drone on for, but would be happy to hear what's on your minds. And Professor Yoder here will call the questions, so that if you didn't get attention or are pissed off about it, it's his fault. It's a
thank you.
Was somebody going to take the mic around? I think what we'll do is we'll go section by section, and if there's a question over here, we'll take that, then we'll take one here and go that way to try to be fair. So is there a question in this side of the room?
Thanks, Ambassador. That was great. I have a question about your gut feeling, your relationships with al-Maliki and Karzai. Are they really good guys? I mean, are they like George Washingtons of their countries, or are they, you know, more ethnocentric or sectarian or tribal in their outlook? Are they willing to really make this work?
It's a great question. Okay. You know, I was in Afghanistan. I got to Afghanistan about 10 days after Karzai had been selected to lead the Afghan interim authority. So he had about the same difficulty finding his office as I did mine, and our offices were in about the same shape, heavy bomb damage in each case. Not to be facetious about it, but the challenges that Karzai and Maliki have both faced thus far may make Valley Forge seem like a training exercise. And again, as we have seen in both cases, the fight goes on. You know, I did a couple of years in Iraq, and I'm in Spokane. Maliki is still, well, he's in D.C., but he's still in Iraq. Here's what I would say about both of them. You know, Maliki was picked as prime minister in 2006 because he was seen as a compromise candidate who wasn't going to be a threat to either of the stronger Shia contenders, neither one of which could achieve a majority. And indeed, for the first year or thereabouts of his tenure, the big rap on Maliki was he's not strong enough to get the job done, to face the challenge. That's not what you hear much anymore. Now you hear, well, he's too strong. And having watched that progression, the spring of 2008, following a number of events that made it politically and militarily possible for him, he took on Iran-backed Shia militias in Baghdad and in Basra, Iraq's second largest city. And that was pretty breathtaking. Here was the Shia prime minister of Iraq with the guns not yet silent from this vicious Shia-Sunni conflict, turning the guns of his own federal forces on his co-religionists. But it worked. And it established Maliki first as a winner. And let me tell you, in Iraqi politics, the strong man and the strong man winning is key to survival. He established that. The Sunnis, for the first time, saw him as a national leader. So he's shown some real courage, a lot of political acumen, and it's fun to watch him as he works this campaign up to national elections, where he's making alliances here and breaking them there and reaching out to Sunnis here and whacking them there. He's pretty good at this. Someone, I think, of great personal courage and commitment. Now, will he be able to face the coming challenges? Who knows? As I am with many of these leaders who have their lives on the line, quite literally, I have been impressed with both his developing abilities and his resolve. Hamid Karzai had an even more challenging situation. If Iraq was and is hard, Afghanistan is way harder, because Afghanistan comes to us and its people after 30 years of just nonstop violence. I mean, from the Soviet invasion of 79 right up to today, Afghanistan has been in the throes of conflict. So no infrastructure, no institutions, a people brutalized and traumatized by war, broken down into the basic denominators of social organization, families and tribes, national identity, a dim memory. So he has had his hands more than full as he's tried to wrestle with all of that. And like Maliki, many years in exile, where I think neither of them had the fingertip feel for dynamics within their own countries. So very steep learning curves as well. I was pleased and relieved to see that Karzai has accepted the findings of the two election commissions and has committed himself to a runoff election. I think that, again, is the soul of wisdom for him. you got to see some of this play out because Senator Kerry was there. Normally, we like to keep our hands a little more concealed. There was a huge U.S. role in wickering all of that, and that role will be vital in the political development of both countries over a considerable period of time. The fact that 8 years into this, Karzai is still the leader of Afghanistan, to me, is fairly extraordinary in itself. He's got to do some things differently. He knows that. But he's going to need our support to get them done. And the same with different emphases and different priorities is also true for Maliki. They have led. They can lead their countries. They are going to need significant international support, and the United States has to lead that support.
Question right there.
Thank you. One of the most, successful events in the war in Iraq was the sort of Sunni tribal awakening in the Al-Anbar region. But given that most of the people involved in that have agreed that there's sort of an internal genesis, in other words, that the coalition didn't bring it about, but rather took advantage of it when it came to be, especially keeping in mind that you mentioned that it's important when looking at the diplomacy to keep a sort of culturally relevant, if I understood you right, approach to dealing with a particular country's internal problems. What do you think will be the best way to sort of not only foster that interaction between an insurgency and an occupying force, but also foster that in other parts of the world? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's kind of a cosmic question. The Sunni Awakening movement was kind of the key event that spun a vicious circle into a virtuous circle. Because the Sunni Awakening changed attitudes in the Shia community. Suddenly they saw those that had been under arms against them directing their shots at Al-Qaeda and its affiliates, mortal enemies of the Shia as well as the Sunni. That caused Shia to reevaluate their own dependency on the extremist militias. That created a political climate in which Maliki could make his move in April of 2008. So, again, a critical moment for Iraq. Now, I would suggest that we did have a fair amount to do with it. The Sunnis in Anbar had tried this before in 2005 out in the West, and they literally got their heads handed to them by Al-Qaeda when they tried to take them on. What was different this time with the announcement of the surge, the additional troops that were going into Anbar at the beginning of 2007 was their sense that we had their backs. And in some cases, the Marines would park tanks in front of key awakening leaders' houses, just as a symbol. So I think we did have a significant contributing role in this. Here again, one's enemy is important. Al-Qaeda was its own worst enemy because it violated the norms, customs, and traditions of the Anbaris in a major way, and wreaking major violence as they did so. So you had a population who said, we have had it with these guys. Just give us the means to take it on. Now you're seeing another transformation underway. And there are a lot of unhappy awakening figures out there who say, well, hey, we stood up with you guys, and now you're pulling out, and what's going to become of us? Well, those are unanswered questions. I think the more farsighted are spending a lot of time and effort to prepare themselves for these national elections. And you see a number of awakening leaders now forming and reforming political coalitions as they make kind of a triple transformation in, say, a three-year period from insurgent to armed ally of the U.S. and at least implicitly their own federal government into a political role. Not all of them will make that transition, but I don't see the wherewithal for a reignition of that insurgency. I think Iraq has moved on. Now, your key part of that question is, so what does this tell us about other events and other contingencies? There's been debate about that with Taliban. Are there good Taliban as well as Taliban, as bad Taliban? How can you separate them out and so forth? I don't know the answers to all of that. I do know that you're not going to, you can't begin to do that until you have a coherent policy that we're still working on. I suspect that once that policy is in place, assuming it is a broad counterinsurgency strategy, that opportunities are going to emerge in Afghanistan as well. They will be different. Certainly, it is a different country with a different traditions and a different history. I think we do have people in place who are extremely well positioned to understand, identify, and exploit those differences and those opportunities. Stan McChrystal, our overall force commander there, is, I think on almost year five of his engagement in Afghanistan, and Carl Eikenberry, our ambassador, was McChrystal's predecessor twice removed as force commander. So we've got people in this who really do understand it pretty well, and I think there will be some parallel, though different, opportunities in Afghanistan. Fascinating to watch what the Pakistanis are doing, because in that particular theater, we are not engaged at all with boots on the ground. This is a Pakistani show. And they're in the fight of their lives, and what you see them doing, of course, is both the hammer and the outstretched hand as they go after the elements of the Taliban that they have identified as seeking to bring down the Pakistani establishment while doing some deals with other tribal elements out in South Waziristan to take them out of the fight. We'll see how effective that is, but again, they live in those regions, and we may learn a thing or two worth knowing from watching how the Pakistanis do this on their own side of the line.
I'll take questions here, and then I'll let some people on the floor ask a question. You've given up your seat. So.
Mm-hmm. If you can get a student or two, it'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. I came from Iraq before 4 months, and I just need to, if you just give me a couple minutes to, you mentioned something about the Sunnis and Shiis. I am part of the Iraqis there, and I know. But this is just to, the Iraqis were stuck between a rock and a hard place. This is the agreements, our secret agreements between Iran and Syria, and they are, you know, if you just see the map, the Afghanistan, all the members are from Al Qaeda, they just going through Iran and going to Iraq, and we are the victims, the Iraqis, because we are belong to cities, and you know, so my question is, in your opinion, how long it still, if the still the secure in Iraq until he get his safe, he will be safe soon. This is just my concern. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and again, that's why I spent a few minutes talking about the view of the region, Iraq and the U.S. as seen through the lenses of Damascus and Tehran. These aren't really secret agreements. These have been pretty open agreements for more than a quarter of a century. And it's why I think the actions that the Iraqis took in standing up to the Iranian-backed militias and some of the support we gave have reminded Iran of an important fact, that Iraq is still Iraq. And I guess I would add this to my lessons list. I abbreviated it a bit in the interest of time. I touched on it, but we'll make it a full-fledged lesson. And that is the persistence of political culture. There was a time in this country in which there was the view that, well, because the majority of Iraqi Arabs were Shia and there was a Shia-led government, and because Iranians are Shia, Iran therefore was going to own Iraq. That ignores the history between those two countries, and in particular the 8-year Iran-Iraq war, initiated by Saddam, certainly, but seen by most Iraqis as the great patriotic war. Didn't matter, you know, the folly of who started it. This was a fight for Iraq's national and its quintessentially Arab identity. And it's remembered with great bitterness on both sides of the border. So there are definite limits to what Iran can do. Syria is a particularly interesting challenge, and that goes back to the first lesson. There are no easy choices in foreign policy. The Obama administration decided that one way it would be different from the Bush administration was outreach to Syria, that we would send an ambassador to Syria after a hiatus of over 5 years, that we would upgrade our relationships, and that that does hold some promise, but it ran you right up against another set of complexities, which is that the Iraqi government didn't like it at all. They hold the Syrians responsible for the horrific bombings in Baghdad in August, and then see us extending a hand to the guys who, you know, ran the bombers, as the Iraqi government sees it, into Baghdad. So here's a nice little dilemma for the new administration. What Syria are you dealing with, and what is that Syria doing to countries with which you're allied, and how do they see it? Again, a lot of history between Iraq and Syria, not much of it good. And again, I think we again see a persistence of political culture in both states. Otherwise, I'll start asking them. I mean, see who listened.
Or a question from a student anyplace. I think we've had questions from...
Right here in front of you.
Right here.
He could hear me, but you guys probably couldn't. He talked about it being the issue of the month, Afghanistan, and The Economist this week had a number of articles about it, and one thing they brought up was that the complexities when you try and introduce nation building into the efforts in Afghanistan, and I was wondering what you thought about that, if nation building is something we should be doing or not.
Yeah, as one looks at Afghanistan, the flavor of the month, and wrestles with what should we do about it, the question posed is, well, what about nation building? What does that mean in an Afghan context? Can it be done? Should we do it? And that, obviously, is part of the current assessment that's going on in Washington right now. Because it gets into, you know, really tough issues. And it goes back to my first lesson I laid out for you, the imperatives of American exceptionalism. Well, you know, do we have some form of moral obligation to give Afghans the guaranteed chance for a better life, to build the schools that will give their kids education, and to ensure there are teachers in those schools and to ensure that those schools are secured, not just this year and next, but over time. Do we have a moral obligation to do the right thing for Afghan women who have suffered hideously, not just under the Taliban, but under the Mujahideen who got to Kabul before the Taliban did at the end of the 80s? And then how much is all this going to cost? How long will it take? And is it even doable? Can we take those noble principles and actually make them work realistically in these very different societies and circumstances? It's a huge problem. It's interesting in the case of Afghanistan. Some Afghans will assert that the very best of times for urban women in Afghanistan was during the Soviet occupation, because that was a tenet, of course, of the Soviet Union. Equal opportunity, equal responsibility. But boy, when the Mujahideen arrived in those towns a few months after the Soviets left, the backlash was extraordinary. So here's another nasty little moral question. How moral is it if you start out on some of these roads, getting women into public life and so forth, if you're not absolutely determined that you're going to stay the course and see that you don't get the same kind of backlash somewhere down the line? So these are huge, hard questions, and I think they're harder for us as Americans than they are for other nations, again, just because of our sense of who we are and where we came from and how that informs how we look at the world. My own view is it's going to be very hard. Look, right now you've got half the American people who think we should just be out of Afghanistan completely. That we should not even sustain the current level of commitment, let alone go beyond it. So I think it's going to be very tough to get the popular support that you would need for a full-up nation-building strategy. And even that would still beg the question, is with all of the commitment and resources, can you do it and can you sustain it? Because ultimately, it has to go on beyond by itself after a certain point. We can't be there forever. Again, lesson one, no easy answers.
Okay, I think we have time for two more questions, so I'll take them from any place. I hear another student.
I was wondering if you could comment on the Iranian-Afghanistan relationship, and also if maybe briefly on the recent Iranian election and how that's going.
Yeah, again, it's a great question. I'd made the comment about Iran's support for Sunni Islamist groups in the Palestinian territories and how those groups really are the ideological enemy of the Shia Islamic Republic of Iran. That certainly applied in Afghanistan. Afghanistan under the Taliban and Iran almost went to war in 1999. Again, because this wasn't just geopolitics. This was who was rightly interpreting the voice of God. It doesn't get more absolute than that. In consequence, the Iranians were very happy to see the Taliban come down, and I was involved in negotiations with the Iranians beginning in September 2001. In fact, the first night that planes were flying again, I was on one to Geneva to meet with Iranians under UN auspices to talk about post-Taliban Afghanistan. So we actually had an interesting collaboration with the Iranians at that time. That produced some results favorable to them, to us, and to Afghanistan. That was then. This is now. Iran now is supporting the same Taliban that they almost went to war with, because it's a way of getting at us. If the administration is able to develop a dialogue with Iran, which is, I think, very much in question, I hope it will be a chance for both sides to kind of see again, looking at Afghanistan, if that could be the one issue where we do have something in common and can kind of recalibrate there. And the second part of that was? The Iranian elections, yeah. My own sense is, and this is my awful, cynical, amoral self speaking, I thought we made way too much over those elections. A lot of idealistic young Iranians got it in the neck, literally, but they did not have a hope, a single hope, of affecting dramatic political or social change. Because what was that election about? It was about two hard-right anti-American Islamists, Ahmadinejad and Mir Hussein Mousavi. Mir Hussein Mousavi was the prime minister of Iran from 80 to 88. He was very much involved in the decisions that led to the creation of Hezbollah. He was involved in the decisions to target the embassy and the Marine barracks. He is absolutely no friend of ours, yet we tended to style him as that because he was going head-to-head with Ahmadinejad, who we definitely knew we didn't like. I'd like to be more upbeat on this than I am. A friend of mine who actually understands history said, look, it's kind of like post-revolution France. We're now in the period of the directory. There is going to be no walking back of the revolution. There is now a debate underway as to who's going to lead it forward, and I think that's what you see in Iran.
Final question.
This question goes back to the question about the possibility of nation building in Afghanistan. Do you see non-government humanitarian efforts playing a role in that in any way, possibly carrying those efforts farther than the U.S. government is willing to commit?
Yeah, that is a great question, and I honestly didn't plan it. The role of NGOs in major international contingencies, it is a very significant role, and there have been some absolute heroes from the NGO community engaged in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, and in Iraq. But here's the challenge. Our adversaries in these places are often equal opportunity killers. They don't care whether you're wearing a uniform or not. If you're representing the West, you're a target. And we have seen that happen all too often to NGO representatives. So the tough question here is, how can you carry out some of those badly needed efforts at relief and at reconstruction and literally physically be able to do it? I am an advocate of much closer links between our military and the NGO community. When I started in Afghanistan at the end of 01, these were two separate universes. We have come a long way, both establishments, since then. There is more to be done. I spoke at the senior conference at West Point in May, and the theme that these brand new second lieutenants had set for their final academic exercise at West Point was the relationship between the United States Army and the NGO community, and it brought together a lot of representatives of both, and it was sure fun to watch. But again, if Save the Children and International Crisis Group and others are going to be effective in areas where that effect is most needed, they got to stay alive to do it. And that means necessarily, as we have now watched this develop in Iraq and in Afghanistan, some association with military forces. So I think that's key. It's fascinating to watch the premier NGO of all NGOs operate, and that's the International Committee of the Red Cross, oldest international NGO in existence, and you know, some of the finest people you would ever hope to meet working in some of the toughest places. And what you find is an incredible creativity and flexibility that preserves their mandated neutrality, but lets them take advantage of every creative opportunity under whatever auspices to get something good done. And they've learned that the hard way over many years, and it's still, I think, a work in progress, both for our military and the international NGO community.
In a minute, I'll ask us to give our thanks to Ambassador Crocker for speaking to us tonight, and also for his many years of service to all of us as a country and as people of the world. First of all, though, I want to say just one thing. I asked the ambassador what we could do as a kind of gift for him being here, and I suggested a gift certificate to a restaurant, which we'll find for you sometime. He said, what I'd really like is a Whitworth University sweatshirt.
Hey, there we go. And I got the deluxe hoodie, so it's a
if it doesn't fit, we can get you another set. Just an announcement about tomorrow evening. In this same room, there's going to be a discussion of tonight's talk led by our dean, Dr. Michael Leroy, who was here just a second ago. And on the panel will be Dr. Jennifer Holsinger, Dr. Dale Soden, Dr. Rajat Tanas, and I'll be on it also along with Dr. Leroy. So if you want to continue the discussion, come back tomorrow night. So again, let's thank the ambassador, and thank you all for coming tonight.
Thank you all. Okay.